Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. This weekend marks the 89th Academy Awards. Before we break out the snacks, let's take a deeper look at language in the movies, rather, and how language is used to identify people and sometimes to discriminate. On Monday, Lindsay Klaus presents Dialect Discrimination from Disney to Django, How Hollywood Uses Language to Reinforce Racial Stereotypes. That's part of the Black Hill State University Speaker Series. Lindsay joins us now. Lindsay, welcome to In the Moment.
Hi.
How are you? Lindsay, how do you say your last name?
Klaus. Rhymes with
Klaus. I got it right. Okay. So Monday you have this program called Dialect Discrimination from Disney to Django. I think I'm saying Django right, too, so
yes.
It's a pronunciation day. Tell me how you got interested or what in your background made you want to talk about linguistics, et cetera.
Well, I started studying linguistics as an undergraduate at the University of Kentucky, and I got my bachelor's degree in linguistics there, and then I earned my master's degree in language and rhetoric at South Dakota State. So I've really been interested in it ever since I was an undergrad, and I became particularly interested in sociolinguistics as an undergrad back at UK.
Oh, wow. So this reminds me when I first read the description of your presentation of the movie Crash, which won an Oscar for Best Picture, and there's a scene where I think it's Terrence Howard is, you know, is he the director of the movie? Or he's the producer. Anyway, the actors are told to talk more black. And he sort of stands there for a minute and says, well, what does that even mean? And that's what it brought to mind for me, is the sort of notion of directors having a preconceived notion of how someone should sound. What does it sort of mean to you? What are we looking at?
Yeah, it's really interesting. When you tell an actor to sound more black, for instance, black English is a dialect of English that linguists have studied pretty extensively. And one of the things that my lecturer is going to be talking about is how these dialects that we think of as wrong or ungrammatical or improper, that they are operating under their own sets of rules. And black English is a great example, and we're going to be looking at a number of examples of black English in film and how it's used. And we're taught primarily by public schools from a very young age that these other kinds of dialects are incorrect, that there's only one standard English, there's only one correct way to speak English. And scientifically speaking, linguistically speaking, that's just not accurate. The Black English dialect has been around for hundreds of years. It has roots in both British English and the African languages that enslaved people brought to this country hundreds of years ago. And it's operating under its own sets of rules of grammar, of pronunciation, of vocabulary. And yet, it's used consistently in film to portray characters as either foolish or ignorant. And in that sense, it continues to reinforce these racial stereotypes that are associated with various groups of people.
So there must be a positive way then to use dialect from all kinds of dialect, from the different English dialects and accents to around the world. So what makes a good use of dialect in the movies, and what makes a flawed use of movie dialects?
Well, a good use of dialect would be a diverse use of it. We can all agree that we'd like to see diverse casts of characters in films, that we'd like to see people of color and women in leadership roles and hero roles, that's important. And the same is true with dialects. It's important to see people who speak stigmatized dialects, such as Black English, such as Chicano English, such as Appalachian English. Right now, we really only see those characters that speak that way portrayed as foolish or ignorant, sometimes even as dangerous. We need to see people speak that way in leadership roles, in hero roles, and we almost never see that in mainstream film. It's extremely rare.
How important is it to get the dialect right? So if you're learning, you know, if an actor is studying to play a part, how important is it for them to get to have the proper language coaching to get it right? Say they've got a strong, juicy character that's effective. They have to nail the language too, don't they?
Sure, absolutely. And I think we can all agree it's pretty distracting when someone's trying to fake an accent and they're not doing it very well. We can probably all think of films where we've seen that happen. I'd say it's pretty important just for, you know, the quality and the enjoyment of the film, but it's also a good idea to simply hire actors who speak those dialects natively. Black actors and people of different races from the South who grow up speaking a strong Southern dialect, when they get to Hollywood, they're virtually always told you have to lose that accent or you have to learn to speak standard English, quote unquote, properly in order to be taken seriously, in order to get roles in mainstream film. And in reality, we need to see those dialects as an opportunity. And, you know, having more actors with more diverse dialects under their belt is going to make it easier for directors or producers to, you know, find the kind of diversity that they want to show in their films.
There's a correlation between this, I think, Lindsay, to how they appear, don't you think? We have a tendency to, you know, dye your hair a certain way or, you know, be a certain weight. We want more diversity, not only in what we hear, but what we see.
Oh, absolutely. And I think things are improving. Certainly, if you look at the Oscars, for instance, which we've been talking about, you know, the hashtag #OscarsSoWhite was trending this time last year because all of the Best Actor and Actress nominees were white. And this year, of course, we see a lot more diversity, which is absolutely a great improvement. And we see, you know, more female characters in leadership roles and hero roles. So things are getting better, but they still got a long way to go, both in terms of diversity of what we see and what we hear. Absolutely.
So let's talk about some of the shiny examples of directors that got this wrong. Can you bring some titles to mind?
Yeah, absolutely. With Black English in particular, virtually any film, mainstream film, in which you hear a character speaking Black English, they are doing it for the purposes of being funny or being depicted as foolish or ignorant. And for example, one of the examples that I love to use a lot in my classes and that we're going to look at the lecture on Monday is The Lion King. And people think, well, it's not even people, it's lions. How can race have anything to do with it? And the cast that does the voices in The Lion King is quite diverse. But all of the heroes across the board speak standard English, whereas the villain Scar the lion, and then the hyenas that are voiced by Whoopi Goldberg and Cheech Marin, the hyenas are portrayed as dumb, as foolish. They're the whole reason that Scar's plan doesn't work, because they're not able to kill a little lion cub. And they speak Black English and Chicano English, respectively. And it's a perfect example of how those dialects are used to portray a character that's not even human as silly and stupid, whereas the smart villain sounds British. And
right.
So many British villains in American movies, that's a different topic altogether.
So does that balance out with James Earl Jones playing Mufasa there, or does that add to it somehow?
Well, if you think of a child's perspective, and of course children are the target audience for that film, you know, a young child doesn't know who James Earl Jones is. They simply hear someone speaking standard English, and of course he's you know, very eloquent. He has a very distinctive voice. So children who grow up speaking Black English and hearing Black English in their homes and in their communities, and that's the language of their family and their neighborhoods, they see or hear that dialect in film only associated with stupid and foolish people. And that can really have a negative impact on their view of their own language, on their view of themselves. It's very similar to the way that white beauty standards are often applied to women of color. When you are taught that, you know, simply by having dark skin or, you know, kinky hair, that's not attractive. It's very similar. If you grow up hearing that your language is wrong, that smart, educated people don't speak that way, it can have a really negative effect on your self-esteem and on your view of your own family and your own neighborhood.
So how about some of the films that are doing it right, that are pushing us forward to what can we look to and say that's a good example of movement in the right direction, if not perfection?
There are a few. There are very few, but there are some. Moonlight, which of course is nominated for Best Picture, is a great example. I wish that film was more mainstream. I hope more people will go out and see that film. The cast is almost entirely Black. I believe all the speaking roles are Black people, and the vast majority of them speak Black English, and it's it's not a big deal. It's simply the way they talk in the movie. It's not used to depict them one way or another. It's simply the dialect that they use. And not only is that, you know, good for linguistic diversity, but it's also simply accurate because that's how many people in those communities talk on a daily basis. Rogue One is another good example. We see Diego Luna, who is, I believe, the second billed role in that movie, and he is from Mexico, and he speaks with pretty noticeable Spanish accent, Mexican Spanish accent. And that's another example of a dialect that is usually used to depict people as silly or as foolish. But in that movie, he's one of the heroes, and he's not depicted as foolish at all. Django Unchained, the 2012 Quentin Tarantino film, is another example. That's where part of my lecture title came from. In that film, Django is the hero. He's a freed slave. He speaks Black English to the entire film. And he also is not portrayed as foolish or stupid. In fact, he's the hero, and he gets to save the day by outsmarting the white people.
How about a film like Moana that mixes in a lot of, you know, there's a diverse cast to Moana, and some use of, I believe it's the Samoan language, but I guess I'm not sure, and a lot of working with different Pacific Island nations. Have you seen that one, and how did they do?
I haven't seen the whole thing. I've seen clips of it, and I think that's great. I think incorporating languages other than English into entertainment, especially entertainment for kids, is awesome. The more that children can be exposed to different dialects and to different languages at a young age, you know, the better. You know, being exposed to foreign languages has been shown to increase children's empathy. Learning other languages over time is good for your brain. It's been demonstrated that it delays Alzheimer's. So the more children are exposed to foreign languages, even if it's just in little bits like that, but the more children are able to see linguistic diversity in the world, the better.
How about Native American dialects?
There is such a thing as Rez dialect, which I think people okay. who live in South Dakota would recognize when they hear it. You almost never see it in film. And when you do see it, of course, it's usually associated with an extremely stereotyped Native sure. character.
Okay, so I got that wrong. There's no Native American dialects, but there's various languages.
Well, there is. Rez dialect is a thing. It's a dialect of English.
Okay.
And it's, again, if you've spoken to Native people, especially people that have grown up on a reservation, you probably know it if you hear it. But there are also Native American languages out there, of course.
Right.
You know, Lakota, obviously Dakota and Nakota are all Native American languages. You know, we almost never see them in film, of course. Dances with Wolves is one notable exception. But I think, you know, a lot of people would agree that just as we want to see more representation of all races in film, it'd be awesome to see more representation of languages and dialects in film.
And I could talk to you all day, Lindsay, because I have a huge interest in language and linguistics, too. But I guess we'll ask you one more question, and that's, do dialects change over time? So if you're going to portray, or an actor's going to portray, a Cockney accent or a New York accent, maybe there's a difference between a dialect and an accent. So now I want to know everything.
Sort of like the layperson term, you know, most laypeople would simply say a Southern accent. In linguistics, accent just refers to pronunciation, whereas a dialect can have different grammar, different vocabulary. So dialect is really just sort of the more scientific term. But for laypeople, they pretty much mean the same thing. They absolutely do change over time. All living languages are constantly in a state of change. Southern accents or Southern dialects are a great example. In the past, up until maybe 50, 60 years ago, we think of the Southern gentleman as not pronouncing his R, sounding kind of British, sort of like Kevin Spacey's character on House of Cards. But in reality, that particular part of that pronunciation is dying off, and most Southern people do pronounce R's now. So, yeah, dialects are always constantly in a state of change.
All right. Lindsay Klaus, presents Dialect Discrimination, From Disney to Django, How Hollywood Uses Language to Reinforce Racial Stereotypes. That's Monday, February 27th. at the Rapid City Speaker Series event at Black Hills State University. Lindsay, thank you so much for your time. So fascinating.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Sleeping Beauty next Saturday at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. She joins us now live in our University of Sioux Falls studios. So we'll talk about fairy tales and ballet. Michelle, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. When we do our ballets, we try to reach all aspects of the audience, knowing that some people really love the classical side of ballet.
Sure.
Other people like a little bit more movement. That's what draws them in, is the costuming and the great lighting and the backdrops. But we also try to add a little bit of humor, too, so for the younger kids in the audience, that they can really enjoy certain aspects of the show, too, even if they're not old enough to understand the technical aspects of it.
So the source material is not the fairy tale. The source material is the Tchaikovsky ballet.
That is correct.
That's where we're going back. So is that where the music comes from, too?
That is where all of the music comes from.
That sounds lovely.
It is. It's just beautiful, beautiful music. And again, because there's so much music to this four-hour ballet, we've tried to pare it down and use it. So it might not be the same placement of music as you might see, like, from American Ballet Theater or something when they present their Sleeping Beauty. But it's very fun. It has a nice flow to it.
In South Dakota, do you have, an audience that's aware of that, though? Or is it most people in the audience, is it going to be fresh, too?
I would say half and half, to be quite honest. There are a few pieces where you have Aurora's big entrance. Most people who've listened to classical music at all will go, I know that.
That's it. Yeah.
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 So
maybe
definitely.
You heard it in the elevator and
exactly.
It was being forced into that
and
small
if it's
package.
New to you, you're going to love it, because this music is just easy to listen to. It flows well. It makes you feel good. It makes you feel some drama and some happiness. So it's really
all ages.
All ages.
Kids, little ones and up. So what do the little shavers do?
The littlest ones in this show, because it's kind of a hectic schedule we have with between rehearsals and two shows back to back, the youngest student is 6, and they do a little section that they're forest nymphs. And at the end, when Aurora and the prince get married, they're little flower girls as well.
Oh,
so they get to be incorporated into it, but we try to make it low stress, but yet great fun. And then as they get older, their parts, they have multiple parts. And then, of course, we have the eldest girls that are in high school, college, that are the main fairies. And their expertise on their point work in this show is just beautiful.
Let's talk about point work and how you sort of advance from a 6-year-old studying ballet to a young adult really performing ballet at that level.
It takes a lot of commitment.
Okay.
But, when they're younger, we try to instill more of the joy and the fun of dancing and try to build up their skill that way. So as their classes get a little bit longer, then that's when more of the intensity comes up. But we try not to overwhelm the students, especially in this area when, kids are available, have the access to be able to do all kinds of things. We want to make sure that they really love their ballet classes. So then when they're about 11 and 12 and we think they're ready, that's when they actually go on their point shoes.
Sure.
And, some, it's like anything else. Some people are naturally gifted at it and others have to work a little bit harder at it.
Yeah.
So obviously the girls that have advanced to the level that they have now have a lot of commitment. They're there 3 nights, 4 nights a week. They wear their shoes, all during ballet classes, not just one point class per week. So,
okay.
Yeah.
So most dancers probably go on to do something other than dance professionally, but some want to keep going. How do you
definitely.
Help those young, is it just women at this point that you have?
We've actually had 2 male dancers from our studio that have gone on to be very successful on the West Coast. One is with Ballet West, and the other one is doing with an independent company in Oregon and, kind of doing his thing. So it isn't just women, but we also have a lot of dancers throughout. I've been doing this 33 years, so we probably have maybe 15 to 20 women that have gone on to do a more advanced level of either performance or working with the school. We currently have students that have done the Joffrey Ballet program during the summer and are looking to continue on that
way. So they have to stay healthy.
They have to stay
healthy. And you must have to hit certain developmental milestones. You can't push them too fast,
correct.
I'm guessing.
That
about
is
all
correct.
This. So yes. Being under the guidance of somebody who really understands that has to be key.
Yes, and one of my philosophies with our studio and when we do shows is to remember first and foremost that they're a student and that right, you yeah. want them to have a healthy body and a healthy mindset when they're 30 and when they're 40. You just don't use somebody in the moment just because it behooves you.
Sure.
You know, you make sure that you develop them emotionally, and we try to help a little bit, you know, spiritually and ethically. And, you know, there's a lot more to it than just show up for class.
Because they'll spend a lot of, the ones who are truly devoted will spend a lot of time in that studio. So you're, you know, part of their family.
Definitely.
Part of that, the adults who guide them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big responsibility.
It is, but I love every
rewarding.
Moment of it.
Yeah.
I love every moment of it.
Let's talk a little bit about dance audiences in South Dakota and and really across the state. I mean, if you can't make it to see Sleeping Beauty, find the dance in your community, right?
Oh, definitely.
How do you approach that as an audience member for the first time?
You know, one of the things is that you have to get online. And if you usually look at, you know, there are so many facilities like NPR Radio that are really good about housing information on their website about upcoming classes or companies that are on tour that you can go through. And a lot of companies actually offer master classes as well. But I know that for the most part, if people really want an outreach and you're in the middle of nowhere, I say reach out, you know, call Main Stage and say, hey, this summer, can you come out for a 2-day event in our community just to kind of get people the exposure that they want and, you know, to see if it's something that they like.
I had to write a feature story once for a magazine about adult ballet. And to do this, I took a month of adult ballet class.
Good for you.
And it was fabulously fun. I wanted to buy all the outfits. You know, that's the first thing I wanted to do. I resisted because I knew it was. I did buy some, you know, sort of early shoes to sort of be in class with. How can adults sort of enter the world of ballet just for health and just for the joy? Because I found a lot of joy that day just doing it. I didn't want anyone
certainly.
To watch me doing it.
Oh, certainly. We have a lovely adult program.
Do
we
you?
Have
oh,
every. We have yeah. had adults that are 40-something that just start for the first time, going all the way up. I think one of my oldest students is 67 right now,
wow.
and she's as limber as a little high schooler and just wonderful. And you have a lot of girls that are in their 20s and 30s that danced when they were younger and are just now tapping back into it. You know, it really is just something that you just have to be, have the courage to step up and say, I want to try this. I want to try this. And that's why every summer we hold a 5-week session and always offer a beginning adult ballet and stretch class. And we say there are no uniforms. You can wear your jogging pants, whatever makes you feel comfortable about this.
But I really wanted the outfits.
We have half and half. You want to wear your skirt or you want to wear your sweats. Either are good.
I wore my sweats, but I really, in my heart, I have to admit I wanted the outfit.
Yeah,
so.
It's so good physically, but it's also good mentally because if you've experienced ballet, you have to learn brief little combinations, and it really keeps your mind engaged as well, along with the French terminology of all of the vocabulary words.
All right. So Sleeping Beauty is next Saturday, 2 p.m. and 7. Where is it at?
It is at the Washington Pavilion. And we're also doing a special thing for the 2 p.m. show where we invite kids to dress up as their favorite princess and sit in the audience to watch the show. And then afterwards, our leads and our fairies will be in the lobby so they can take pictures with them and meet them and look at their pointe shoes and their tutus and all of that. So
I love it.
Yeah. We're hoping it'll be a super fun event.
What's it like for those older dancers to sort of give that back, because there was probably a moment they remember that they first
it just the other
wanted
night,
to be on that stage.
Just the other night, we were in rehearsal, and I wished I would have had my camera to see these little girls looking up at the big girls. Just, and I just remember all those big girls being those little girls,
right?
And picking out which dancer you wanted to be and who you wanted to be most like.
Oh.
So it's beautiful to watch the interaction of generations
doing good work in the world.
Yes.
Michelle Running. You can see Sleeping Beauty next Saturday, 2 p.m. and 7. Check out Dance Productions in your own town as well, Michelle. Thank you so much
thank
for being
you so
with
much
us today.
For having me.
We appreciate it. Dancing is a discipline that takes years of learning and practice to master. The Choose Art performance is showcasing a young dance group in an effort to keep kids away from drugs. The dancers have been performing for over a decade. SDPB's China Lockett has more from their rehearsal.
11 dancers move silently on stage as the choreographer counts to the tempo. Their hair is tied tight behind their heads. Each is dressed in all black except for a pair of white gloves with outlines of eyes drawn on the palms. Allie Martin is an 11th grader. She is one of 12 girls in a student dance company at the Academy of Dance Arts in Rapid City.
I choreographed Ocular Curiosities, which is a piece all about the human eye.
Martin's piece is part of the third annual Choose Art performance, Addiction Reframed. Middle and high school students submitted visual artwork during Red Ribbon Week. Students in the company chose images that inspired them and created original routines for the event.
Mine is this bright orange background piece of art and has these big, bold black eyes in it. And so I was like, that's really cool looking.
She put together a dance that represented what the image made her feel.
I took my piece and I decided that I wanted it to be more aggressive and more direct with the movement. And I really wanted to use that type of movement to convey kind of the boldness and the real punch that the piece of art had.
The performance is a collaboration between the Academy of Dance Arts and the nonprofit Lifeways. Sarah Olivier directs the student company at the Academy. She says the project was created to show students that expressing themselves through art is an alternative to substance abuse and risky behavior.
We want young people to know that we respect them, we applaud them, we celebrate them for their work and for their achievements as young artists.
She says she believes art education is the anti-drug in schools. The project is funded by grants and local donors. Olivier says proceeds go to Lifeways to help them support young people in need.
I have so much trust in these students. They're just really tremendous people, and really this is their show, and I just have complete faith that they are going to carry the day. I just feel so blessed to get to work with these amazing young people.
The show also features a variety of musicians and poets from Rapid City area high schools. Two students appear on stage. One is dressed as Ash Ketchum from the Pokemon cartoon series. She leaps and spins as Cameron Richardson performs the show's theme song on her violin. Richardson says the two put the performance together after hearing an adaptation by
Lindsay Sterling. She's a popular violinist who does a lot of pop songs and plays with popular artists.
Richardson is in 10th grade and says she's been playing the violin and dancing for nearly 13 years. She says she chose this routine
just for fun, yeah.
She says a company has been practicing at least once a week since October.
A lot and a lot of rehearsals, and it's very exciting. This year's very, very different than past years, I feel like. We're more prepared and we all have more experience, and it's going to be really cool.
Richardson is also part of several group performances. 11 students wearing black leotards and tights with different colored skirts appear. They pair off and twirl around stage, each couple moving differently. Maya Zoller is in 12th grade.
I choreographed the piece titled Idiosyncrasies of Life, and it was inspired by this beautiful artwork that had a cityscape in it.
She says she used minute movements in this piece.
All of the movement was very confined to their own person. There wasn't a lot of really expressive movement. As a viewer, as an audience member, you really had to pick up on the little things in it, and there was just so much going on all the time, just like a life in a city.
Five students dressed as characters from Alice in Wonderland tap their way onto stage. Some are wearing a tall hat, a dress scattered with playing cards, antennas, whiskers, or animal ears. Maddie Baldwin is in 12th grade. She's the White Rabbit.
The seniors all knew that we wanted to do a piece together, and we found this wonderful painting of the Mad Hatter, and we based our whole piece off that, and we wanted to do a tap number.
The students worked together to choreograph this performance. She says they watched the movie for character research, then paired tap movements with the perfect song.
You feel really powerful. You like walk out and you're like, I'm making noise, and you're not supposed to make noise when you dance. Like the first step I do, I feel like I capture the audience's attention right away.
Baldwin says she is also performing her first solo dance this year. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Trina Lockett in Rapid City.
The Choose Art performance is scheduled for Saturday, February 25th at the Performing Arts Center. Let's have a poem. This is Norma Wilson.
listening to morning classics. I'm driving on a white carpet of snow. Diamonds sparkle in all the little trees, and all the world is waltzing. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. The young women of Baden-Baden in long white gowns are gracefully turning like swirling snow. The stubble of corn is gold, and nothing in this world is mundane. It's a January morning, and until the music stops and everything turns gray, we can pretend that nothing has shattered.
A poem by Norma Wilson this February morning. That's from the 1993 issue of The Long Neck. It was first published under the title Listening to Public Radio on the Way to Vermilion. Guitar Masters are up next. You're in the moment, SDPB Radio. To In the Moment, I'm Lori Walsh. It's time now for Moment in Sound. This week, we welcome some of the Guitar Masters. The Guitar Masters concert series celebrates 20 years of round-robin-style concerts. Joining us today from the SDPB studios in Rapid City, we welcome Bob Fahey and Scott Ballou. Am I getting your names right, Bob?
That's correct.
All right. Welcome, Bob and Scott.
Good
How
job.
About you? Is it Ballou?
Good
All
job.
Right.
I'm
Excellent.
I'm impressed.
And also with us, I think we have Darla Drew, his manager of some sort. She's making it all work, right, Darla?
Yep, I'm putting this thing together, and you know, it's in its 20th year, so I must be doing something right. And great people to work with, and masters from the South Dakota scene as well as from the Arizona music scene. So it's going to be a great show.
So tell me, Darla, then, about sort of the inspiration behind a round robin sort of concert style, and what kind of interaction and sort of spontaneous collaboration that might bring.
Well, you know, this started 20 years ago as a small concert with three guys at the Doll Fine Arts Center in the small cyclorama room at the Doll. And it was one night. And then from there it grew to just have this reputation of presenting the best in guitar players around the area. So as the crowds grew and we added another guitar master, we actually had to add another night because the place was selling out. So that's just good accolade, a little story about the success of how this transpired. And yes, when the guys get together, so far I've not found a woman guitar master that I've been able to bring in, but that's probably hopefully looming in the future. But they will exchange licks, you know, it'll just kind of happen organically. And sometimes, you know, somebody will just start joining in, or they will actually plan something together. It's not unusual for the last song of the night to be a jam session where everybody can show off some of their stuff. So yeah, it's just a great night of celebration of all things guitar. And we also have a guitar and gear show going on in the exhibit hall at the Journey. So if you just want to see guitar collections, we have those as well.
All right, I think we better get to some music because that's what people have tuned in for. So let's start with Bob Fahey, and he's the lead singer and guitarist in the blues-infused Suspects band. He's known for his masterful solo work on slide guitar and for his collaborations. Bob, what would you like to start out with?
I'm going to start out with just a kind of a Delta slide tune called Minglewood. I'm playing a National Steel resonator that's on loan from a local music store here, Haggerty. So I appreciate that.
And it's green.
All right, China Locke is going to get a picture, and she's going to put it up online.
Yeah, it weighs as much as a Volkswagen, and it also doubles as a weapon in some clubs.
All right.
Wanted man in Texas, broke down and gone for good. I'm a wanted man in Texas. Bust out, I'm gone for good. You know the sheriff couldn't catch me, but you know that his girlfriend could.
Some stuff I'll do this weekend.
All right. Yeah. Excellent. That it sounds great. If you're just tuning in, Moment in Sound on In the Moment, that was Bob Fahey, and the concert we're talking about is the Guitar Master Concerts. It's scheduled for 7:30 p.m. Mountain Time on Friday, February 24th, and Saturday, February 25th at the Journey Museum in Rapid City. And now, Scott Ballou, what are you playing today, and what are you going to play for us first?
Well, you know, everyone's got songs about something, and since it's 10:30 in the morning, this will be about drinking. And since I just got back from Dallas late last night, I'm feeling it. She did shots, I drink beer. She says you're not what I'm looking for here. I never mix my drinks, and I ain't gonna mix with you. I say you're mean, she says you're wrong. You just some combos don't belong. I never mix my drinks, and I ain't gonna mix with you. Because a man that drinks beer ain't no man at all. He'll leave you when the love goes stale. And a man that drinks beer till they call last call. He calls you when you need him bail. And then he's probably sitting in jail. Well, now I can see that this has nothing to do with me. Your hatred of beer is a man that's done you wrong. When I can change, although it might seem a little strange. I never mix my drinks, but here's what I intend to do. I'll have a Harvey wall banger and an up against the wall slope. And if you sip and go naked, my beer drinking days are through. And honey, I'm drinking liquor with you. She does shots, I drink beer. Says you're not what I'm looking for here. I never mix my drinks, and I ain't gonna mix with you.
Yeah, Scott Ballou. We're talking about the Guitar Masters on Moment in Sound today. I have the biggest smile on my face, which you can't see on the radio, but maybe you can hear in my voice. So great stuff. This is going to be one heck of a night, isn't it? Bob, you've done this before, I take it?
I have, actually. This will be my third opportunity to redeem myself.
Alumni.
on the stage. I'm really looking forward to it. My good friend Chris Hockmay, of course, is coming up from Arizona. He's a well-known, world-class flamenco guitar player, absolutely phenomenal musician, and a great guy. I do some shows with him down in Arizona. I've known Scott for years. We're all looking forward to getting together and really enjoying that. I enjoy it every year. It's so much fun. It's a great camaraderie and a mix of styles. That's a nice thing that the Guitar Masters and Darla do is, you know, they bring in four different genres, basically. And so the audience gets an opportunity to see all of the different styles. And then, you know, at some point in the show, we fuse all of those together. And it's really a lot of fun.
What's the experience like being up there? Because there's got to be, you know, you got to put yourself out there a little bit, too, musically, take some risks.
It's
Scott?
It's nerve-wracking.
It's nerve-wracking.
Go ahead, Scott. Yeah.
Well, you know, I got confused. I thought she said it was bar masters when she came and asked me, because she saw me playing in a bar, and I guess it's not.
No.
So
you have to be good.
No, you know, it'll be interesting playing for sober people. So I'm looking forward to that.
All right, Bob, you want to play another tune for us here?
I sure can.
Excellent.
I'm just gonna do something a little laid back here, just to kind of give you the idea of what slide guitar is really kind of about, and a lot of it is, you know, it's kind of emulates the human voice is one of the things that they were looking at doing. So.
Thank you. That makes my whole day and my weekend. All right, Guitar Master Concert scheduled 7:30 p.m. Mountain Time, Friday, February 24th, Saturday, February 25th. That's at the Journey Museum in Rapid City. Also a talk about guitar collections from some of the Black Hills' most prolific collectors. And that begins at 7 p.m. in the theater. We're going to run out of time here. We're going to let Scott Ballou play us out in just a second. But I want to say thanks to all our guests. Also, thanks today to China Lockett and Steve Munson for their extra help with the program. Kara Hetland and Innovation is coming up next. Scott, take us to the break, please.
Hey, Laurie, before we let Scott take us out, I want to mention Paul Peterson will be there tonight as well as one of our guitar masters. So take it away, Scott.
Good job. I'm kind of crazy about my GPS when she tells me where to go, but gives directions.